Resources of the Joint Ways and Means Committee to order and open a public hearing on House Bill 5018, the Department of Environmental Quality. Mr. Siebert, would you run us through what we have before us today?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at your place you have a couple pieces of information, actually packets of information. One is just a list of all the policy option packages in the department's budget that they've been going over the last few days, and they will be going over the final packages today that are included in their budget. You also have a set of information on one of the questions yesterday regarding the TMDLs and recent court decisions that I'm sure the department will be going over.
Okay.
One of the final packages that you have to discuss is the laboratory rent increase, and I just wanted to remind the committee that there is also a project included in the DAS capital construction budget for a new DEQ laboratory. Actually, it would be DEQ and public health. I believe the amount in the budget is $32 million for construction. There's no debt service in 03-05. The debt service will begin in 05-07. But this subcommittee will be expected to make a recommendation on that project to the Capital Construction Subcommittee when they take that budget bill up.
Mr. Chair, if I might,
Do you have
any idea of the ballpark for the number that the general fund will be indebted to at beginning in 05-07?
I believe the department can discuss that.
Well, maybe there's a better time in this process to do that, too, mm-hmm. when we actually take up the capital construction.
Right, during the capital construction. But my understanding was it was roughly $2 million of new debt service for 05-07.
Okay. You done?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Hollick, would you like to run us through our material here? Then continue on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Stephanie Hallick, the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and I am asking Mike Llewellyn to come to the table with me because a lot of the response we're providing to is in the water program. And also, if you like, since Lisa Pearson is not here today, we have another representative from DAS who might want to introduce himself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Patton with the Department of Administrative Services.
Okay, what you have before you, I was not planning on going over this list of the policy packages. That was just in response to the request from the committee, so you didn't have to keep thumbing back and forth between lists in the book. We put them all in one place. But if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them. With regard to the other questions, the very first question in the letter of response back to you has to do with questions about the TMDL court decision. And there is a series of attachments that go with that. The first attachment is the decision, the Baker County decision in circuit court. The second is a letter to the Department of Ag and to DEQ from the Department of Justice with regard giving us guidance to the with regard to the Haas decision. The third is the so-called Pronsolino case, which was a case, a similar case in California that came up with a different conclusion than the Haas decision came up with. And the last attachment is the consent decree between the Ninth Circuit Court and EPA that establishes the schedule for completing TMDLs in Oregon.
Stephanie Morgan, do you have a question?
With reference to the document on the case, the Ninth Circuit Court case, which is the California case, are there particular parts of this that are more relevant in terms of not having to read the whole thing?
That's an excellent question, Representative Morgan. Can you help, Mike?
I'm not sure I can, other than Representative Morgan. I think in most of the most of these court cases, I believe if you look at the very back, under Roman numeral 4, the conclusion, I believe that just summarizes the court's decision. The very back page, Representative Morgan, recently. I think that's just sort of the bottom line of the decision. And then, of course, the rest of the text just gives the rationale of the court, looking at both sides of the argument that were presented in the court's summary of their decision.
Thank you.
Stephanie, I'm sure it's in your budget, but could you tell us what you're projecting for legal fees?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we've actually addressed that in this letter. In the second paragraph, I've indicated that to date, the state has spent $125,000 on the Hawes case. This was actually split between our department and the Oregon Department of Agriculture. In addition, the plaintiff has requested that they be reimbursed by the state for their attorney fees, which have been $153,000. Judge Baxter has not yet ruled on that request.
And Mr. Chair, if I might,
sure.
Have you made any estimate looking forward if you if the appeal goes ahead, what you can anticipate forward from here in legal expenses?
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Morgan. I talked to the attorneys on this. It's very difficult for them to give us an estimate because it really depends on the discovery that whether they start de novo with discovery, what we have to respond to in terms of affidavits and motions that the plaintiffs present to the court. So it's very open-ended in terms of how long the process goes on and the nature of the arguments. So they're very hesitant to give us an estimate based on their professional judgment.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Perhaps it would be illustrative for the committee if we knew what the $125,000 had been spent on.
Okay. We can certainly do that, Mr. Chair, and Representative Morgan will give the breakdown.
Thank you.
And again, Stephanie, what is in your budget this year for legal services?
Mr. Chair, I don't have the answer to that question. I don't know if that's something that we can look up today, but if I can't get it for you today, I'll get back to you on that. That would be our Attorney General's line item, right? Okay. Okay. Let's see. Unless there's any further questions on these legal cases, I was going to move to the next item that you had asked about, which is the sewer hookup moratoria. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to read all this to you because I think some of this you and I have discussed before, and we've also discussed with Representative Krieger since he has a number of communities in his area. What we actually try and do is, when we have communities that are out of compliance, we try and work on what we call a memorandum of agreement with them for coming into compliance. Unfortunately, we don't have a database that can capture easily all the communities that are either on MOAs or have any moratoria associated with that, so the staff is still compiling the list of cities for you, but we will get you the specific list of cities. But the general approach is to not, that I've described here in this letter, is to not just go in and declare a moratoria, but actually to sit down and work out a plan with the cities that have a problem, and that will generally include a schedule for hookups when certain things happen. And that will give you the list of the cities that are under those kinds of agreements, and there may be something that Mike wants to add to that as well.
Well, I think that's the case where I think there's been at times a perception that the definition moratorium is an absolute moratorium on connection, whereas in reality a lot of the communities that we're dealing with, as Stephanie implied, what we will lay out in the actual order is that if you start the actual construction of the upgrade of the treatment plant or maybe you have a failing pump station, as long as the community is moving ahead on the infrastructure, improvement will allow increased connections as long as there's that progress, rather than an absolute moratorium where you cannot connect until they're fully completed the installation design.
Is that a new policy? How long have you had that policy?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's been our policy for as long as the agency's existed, to my knowledge.
And Mr. Chair, I would just add that it's only been relatively recently that it's been used a lot because some of the systems that were put in a long time ago are now starting to fail. So that's why you're seeing more of it than you did in the past. And I would just add one other thing about the memorandum of agreement is the goal there is usually when we enter into an agreement like that with a city, they have violations and they're having failures. So the goal is to settle those violations without penalty and get in as much as we possibly can and get them on a schedule to compliance rather than being in this mode where we're issuing fines for cities that can't even afford to fix the systems. So. The next question you had asked was with Representative Krieger was with regard to the state revolving loan projects and how many of those had actually failed. And Port Orford was cited as an example. And in the research that we were able to do, what we found is that Port Orford was really a unique situation. Mm-hmm. And we've given a description here on what actually happened in terms of how a decision was made to site the outfall in a certain way and then what happened in terms of the dunes that got washed away and why a really unique problem occurred that we've not experienced before. And we're currently working with Port Orford, as you heard, and we're hopeful they're having another election, I think, in May. That this one, the bond failed by one vote, and I think they're going back to the voters again. And, of course, we're keeping our fingers crossed that they'll be successful this time.
And I might add, Stephanie, that just for the record, I think it's important to clarify that if my memory is correct, originally DEQ strongly suggested an outfall into the ocean.
Right.
And the community insisted they wanted a septic system.
That's correct, Senator.
And the septic system was washed away, and so they brought it on themselves, in my opinion, to a large extent at least. So I don't want the record to look like that the failure was due to the departments.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate that. We really do try and bring our technical expertise to bear as much as folks will allow us to do so. The next thing referenced in the letter is the summary of the policy packages, which I handed out to you. The next item on page 3 of the letter is the effect, consideration of the effect of the Biscuit Fire and potentially how that might impact the TMDLs. And I think it was mentioned yesterday that DEQ is working with the U.S. Forest Service to gather data. And that, in the Illinois River Subbasin, the effort to gather data was essentially completed prior to the Biscuit Fire. And we are ready to analyze the data, and they're now going to have a really unique opportunity because the fire happened to get sort of a reality check, if you will, on this data. So the timing is actually quite good.
Mr. Chair, if I might ask a question.
Yes, Representative Morgan.
Do you have a timeline for when you expect the second set of data to be gathered and the analysis to be done?
I don't in this letter, but I can certainly find out for you.
Thank you.
There was also a question related to that as to whether or not the downstream landowners would be required to do more under the TMDL as a result of the increased stream temperatures resulting from the loss of forest cover. And the answer is no, that there would not be any different requirements. The streams already exceeded the temperature criteria. And it goes on to explain what would have been required anyway. It would be the same things that would have been required regardless of the fire. On the last page, Senator Messerly, you requested the percentage of abandoned tanks that have been removed in the underground storage tank program. At the end of 1998, which was the compliance date, there were 2,275 tanks that were not in compliance. And as of now, about 2,100 or 92% of those have been what we call decommissioning. And decommissioning can mean either removal or filled in place, and the soils are tested.
Well, let me ask Stephanie, what is your sense of how many tanks are out there that just no one knows about?
Do you know, Dick, at this date? My sense is that we've accounted for most all of them. We can double check and see, but we've been at this program for quite some time, and I think we have a pretty good sense of what the universe is. And the only caveat I would put on that is these are commercial underground storage tank facilities. I mean, there may be private tanks, personal tanks. It doesn't apply to heating oil tanks like I had to do at my mom's house when she passed away. And so that's a whole different universe and a large one as well. But in terms of commercial facilities, I think we've got a pretty good handle on it. You had asked a question about requirements for research vessels in terms of emergency preparedness. The the spill contingency plan rules that we have apply to cargo and passenger vessels over 300 gross tons. And research vessels typically do not fall into this category, and so we do not require them to have a plan or pre-staged equipment or response personnel while in Oregon's waters. And I think this was mentioned yesterday that perhaps the maritime pilots have some requirements for bar pilots, but that would not be something under DEQ.
So was that a recent change in policy on the response team?
Is that part of the last rulemaking? Do you know, Dick Peterson?
Okay.
Yes, it is, Senator.
That's right. We talked about that yesterday.
And then finally, Senator Messerly, you'd ask whether the tracking, when the tracking of landfills began, and as near as we can tell, the rules were adopted in 1972, and we actually started tracking permitted landfills that were in operation at that time, and we suspect that there are some that we don't know about that we just simply don't have in our system.
And I would assume that some of those older ones you don't engage unless there's a report or a complaint of a problem?
That's correct, Senator Messerly. And I was just handed a note, and perhaps someone could convey this to Representative Morgan, that the this is governor's balanced budget, is that right? In the governor's balanced budget, the AG budget for water quality is $237,000. And that is it for the follow-up items from yesterday.
Let me, if this might be an appropriate time, I had lunch with Senator Harper today, and he had talked to me a month ago, I guess, about the fund for dry cleaning establishments. And he has an issue I think you're aware of what is the balance in that fund and why is the fee still so high?
Senator Messerly, I know there is an issue, and I know that my staff have been working on it diligently, and Dick Peterson, the Land Quality Administrator, has joined me at the table because I've not been personally involved in those discussions yet.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, Land Quality Division Administrator. Senator Messerly, I can certainly get into the details of this if you would like. There was a hearing yesterday regarding this, and generally what it is the dry cleaner industry back in 1995 came to the legislature and got a bill working with DEQ passed whereby the dry cleaner industry was released from liability for environmental cleanup if two things were basically done, which they agreed to. One is that dry cleaners would come forward and do better in terms of environmental management at the facilities. And two, that they would generate a fund that would pay for environmental cleanup at dry cleaner sites since they are no longer liable. And through fees, a fund has been created and generated. And at that time, in 95, the commitment was to generate $1 million a year from fees to run the dry cleaner program and clean up these sites. And we've never been able to reach $1 million. And the statute has always triggered a fee increase if in fact that $1 million wasn't generated. Well, the same is true this year. And so a bill has been proposed to do a number of things to try to help with that environmental cleanup side of things. I might add that the dry cleaner industry has really stepped forward and has done better than compliance in terms of work at the site, and DEQ has worked with them. But we're not able to get at all the cleanup sites. We have a lot of dry cleaner cleanups that are in the queue. Dry cleaners that have come to us want to work on their site, getting the cleanup done. And we're just not having enough money to pay for those sites. And so at yesterday's committee meeting, there was a good discussion, and the committee asked the department to with the dry cleaner industry, go back and work on some of this to see if we can sort it out. And I think we're at that point now, and we're working hard to try to rectify that situation so we can, in fact, reduce our costs as much as we can, still be involved in the program, yet free up more capital for the dry cleaner program.
How much money's in the fund at this point?
Mr. Chair, right now I think we're projecting that for this calendar year we'll have about around $600,000 and $700,000 in the account.
What do you normally spend per annum out of that fund?
Mr. Chair, following a fiscal that was given to us, we were given three FTEs to run the program, and so we've been spending a little bit less than that actually each year, and it's around it's somewhere around between $250,000 to $300,000. And there's another piece of that too that's under discussion, is the Department of Revenue collects fees from the dry cleaners, and all of us are in agreement that DEQ being more involved in that, and all of us in agreement includes the Department of Revenue and the dry cleaners, that we might be able to be more efficient at collecting fees than them. So that's one area we're looking at too.
And let me clarify, did you say that the $600,000 to $700,000, is that per year or per biennium?
Mr. Chair, that's what we're projecting for this year, for 1 year.
1 year? Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, if there are no further questions, I'll finish up my agency overview, and we can move to the co-chair's questions today. I am on page 31 of the agency overview packet that I handed out on the first day. The title of the slide is Maintaining Environmental Accomplishments. And I'm just going to briefly cover the rest of the policy packages that have not yet been discussed. The first one Paul has alluded to already, which is the laboratory rent increase. Our laboratory is currently located and has been located for 27 years in a converted parking garage on the Portland State University campus adjacent to the public health lab. We have been paying below market rent under a 25-year lease with Portland State, which expires on June 30th of this year. Portland State urgently needs the space. They are leasing commercial space elsewhere, and they've asked the DEQ lab and the health lab to move, but they have granted a short-term lease extension to 2007 with no option to renew. Beginning July 1 of this year, Portland State has increased our rent by 30%. The lab space has been inadequate for some time, as you can imagine, given that it was a converted parking garage to begin with. It had space for about 40 staff. We're up to about 90 staff now, although a little bit less given some of the budget reductions. But we have people sitting in hallways. We have an HVAC system that is inadequate. Every time we want to add a hood, it's on the bottom floor of 8 stories, so it costs $80,000 just to run the vent to the top. There, I can give you the whole litany if you ever want to get into it.
Is your present lab combined with the health department?
Actually, the way we share work, and Dr. Mary Abrams is here, who's the lab administrator, and she can give you as much detail as you want, but they are actually physically mirror images of one another. There's a wall between the two, and then our lab's on one side and their lab's on the other side. And they do the biological analyses, and we do the chemical analyses is generally how it breaks down, and there's different kinds of equipment for that. But there are definitely efficiencies for the state and for the work for us being together. Anyway, so we have been trying to work. We would like to move, and we've been trying to work with Portland State and DAS and the world to find some space. For purposes of the fiscal discussion, I wanted to tell you that the current rent is $646,845 per biennium for roughly 26,000 square feet of space. When we go into the short-term lease, that will increase to $818,772 and 33,625 square feet of space. Portland State has added about 6,800 square feet of what we're calling bridge space until we can get out of there, that gives us some additional storage and office space that we'll be paying for. We have three policy packages in the budget, 171, 172, and 173, that basically just spread the cost of the rent among our three programs, because that's how we pay for that sort of thing. if this general fund that is contained in the governor's balance budget for this rent increase is not approved, it will cost the department between 3 and 4 FTE to pay for the lab increase. We'll just have to eat it, if you will, because that's the other option that there is, because the rent's going to go up. I mean, there's just no choice about that. We, as was mentioned by Paul, that the ancillary discussion has to do with getting out of the building. And we did an extensive work with DAS and the Health Division. We've done a business plan. We had an extensive analysis of what kind of space is needed. We did an extensive review and discussion about co-location options with other agencies. And there's been a lot of work done as background that we'd be happy to provide to you. There is one point of clarification that I particularly want Representative Morgan to know. The method of financing is what's called certificates of participation. That is not a general fund obligation in the same way that selling bonds might be. The debt service is paid by our rent, and the sources of funding for our rent may or may not be general fund. I mean, we get funding, federal dollars, we get fee dollars, whatever. But we actually, the way the debt would be serviced would be from our rent payment. The cost that was quoted of $1 million to $2 million, if it ends up really being a $32 million sale, that's roughly what the cost would be to our agency. And then the Health Division would have some cost as well. Now, all of that said, everyone involved in these discussions is very mindful of the timing. Given the budget situation in the state right now, even if there was an ability to service this debt, is it the right kind of message to be sending to say you're going out and trying to, and it wouldn't necessarily be building a new building. I want to make that very clear. One of the spaces that DAS did find was actually an empty Portland Community College campus building out on Southeast 82nd in Portland that we couldn't get because we obviously didn't have the approval from this body yet, and unfortunately the space has already gone to Goodwill. But it would have been, there was good HVAC, good electrical, it could have been retrofitted in a good way. So there obviously DAS is going to look for lease cost options. We're also leased cost options. We're also discussing with them if there's any way to get the space needs estimate down at all and get the cost down. But all of that said, we may still, in having discussions with you all, conclude that this biennium is not the time to ask permission to sell the certificates of participation. We're going to have to do it sometime. And the degree to which we continue to negotiate with Portland State, I would also say that there's no doubt in my mind if we wanted to drive them to another short-term lease, the cost would probably go up again, so the state would be paying even more money for what is certainly not adequate space where we are now. So it's a difficult problem, but we understand, I think, the ramifications of it.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Stephanie, one of the questions that has come up in the past with respect to state-owned buildings and facilities is how far out, in your case, of the Portland metro area you would look to place such a building. I understand that there are travel issues that have to be taken into consideration, but some of us that represent more rural districts are constantly looking for opportunities to spread out state investment throughout the state. So that's question number one, whether or not you've taken a look at what constitutes your service radius. And secondly, whether or not you have had any discussions with DAS about financing models of a new facility that sounds as though it's badly needed, but financing vehicles that maybe are not the traditional COP kind of financing vehicles. I'm thinking like a build-to-suit with a rental. You guys would be rental rather than incurring state debt. You would just pay off the cost of the building through a long-term rent commitment and do it with rent that would be commensurate with what you're paying now.
Senator Meserle, Representative Johnson, I'll answer both those questions, and if you see either Holly or Mary turning purple behind me, I'd hope you call on them to come and join me at the table in case
one
I'm
of
not
us getting, light purple now.
Not getting it quite right. But the question has certainly come up about where we could locate this lab, and I think that DAS does this search, and I think they have cast a fairly wide net. Let me tell you what the main constraint for either our lab or the health lab is the lifetime of the samples and how quickly we can get samples in from the field and still get good data from those samples. And unfortunately, and I will only take 30 seconds on one of my personal pet peeves, Horizon Air does not fly, or United Express does not fly among the cities in the more remote parts of our state. You have to come back into Portland as a hub. And so there is some limitation with regard to getting samples that have to be flown in and getting them in a timely manner. That is even, I think, more critical, as I understand it, for some of the biological samples that the Health Division deals with. So if we continue to pursue this jointly, we actually have some constraints on where we can look that are driven more by them than by us. And that also pertains to some connections they have to the Oregon Health Sciences University. And again, if we really want to get into an extended discussion, there's other experts who should be at the table than me. But that's the basic problem. So if we can get within drive time, I mean, I think realistically, probably throughout the valley and certain distance out on the US 30 or the I-84 corridor is realistic. But if you're talking about places like Burns or John Day or, you know, really remote, more remote communities, I think it's problematic.
I can say, Representative Johnson, that we've ran into this before centrally located in Portland. Is that what you're driving at, too?
Yeah, or centrally located in Salem. And I know that we had this debate with the discussion about DPSST, and I won't bore anybody with that whole diatribe again. But a sort of cynical process that tantalized some small communities, and the decision was made long before those RFPs ever went out that it was going to stay in Salem. And what I'm looking for is economic opportunity in outlying communities that are not aggregated in Portland, not aggregated in Salem. I'm thinking particular communities that might have large industrial tracts proximate to an airport that could handle instrument traffic somewhere on Highway 30, but that's incidental to any conversation here. But I was asking really the larger philosophical question about how seriously you had looked at your needs versus having a highly desirable facility like you're talking about someplace other than the I-5 corridor.
Representative Johnson, Mr. Chair, it has definitely been factored into the analysis, and I think it would be appropriate for this committee to be given all the background information and all the background work that's been done on this issue. You can tell me if you don't want it, but there's a formal business plan, both from health and from us, and an analysis that addresses a lot of these questions.
Just to finish up, Mr. Chair, I very much appreciate the director's straightforward response, and would that all the other agency heads were as amenable to even having the conversation rather than the pocket decision having been made that it's going to go X place regardless of any other factors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you. I just want to add that if the availability of service to bring samples in is a major factor, even beyond the air carriers that you mentioned, I know that there are services to most of our small communities for banks and UPS and those that, unless you were thinking of personnel travel, that would, you know, come to Salem or any place for that matter.
But right. No, I think that would work, Senator. I do want to mention one other thing, and also, Representative Johnson, you had another question, and I've forgotten what it is, so I'm hoping you remember what it is.
Fortuitously, I do, Mr. Chair.
But before you ask me again, if I may, since 9/11, and since there's two other points I want to make about the metropolitan Portland area situation. And I alluded to one of these earlier. Our lab is now the lab of first response for the first response teams and the FBI when there are any kind of unknown substances that have to be dealt with. Dr. Abrams is on 24/7 call right now because of the war, and she's been asked to have our lab available. So the proximity and the availability of the lab to where there is likely to be some kind of an incident is something that needs to be taken into consideration as well. And also, I think one of the reasons that the lab started out where it is because at that time, most of the regulated sources were around the metropolitan Portland area, and so most of the sample work was coming in that way. And as I said, it was 27 years ago, so things change over time. Okay. And I would be happy to answer Representative Johnson's second question if I could remember what it was.
Take your best shot.
Representative, I think I could take a shot at that. I was asking about the build-to-suit option and then, mm-hmm. and then renting back. Mm-hmm. In some discussions with DAS facilities, that's problematic in this case because of the unique nature of the building being a laboratory and the very limited market there would be for such a building. After the department were done, let's say the risk to the developer is such that unlike just straight office space that they could easily turn around and rent to someone else if there were a problem for whatever reason with the current renter, there would really be a very limited ability to do that in this case.
I guess my only response back to that would be that's a business decision that the developer would make. I would hate to see that option foreclosed simply because DAS was projecting risk onto a developer. Most developers didn't get to be successful by being dummies, and I think that having the opportunity to at least test the market for some of these build-to-suit options, I realize a lab is unique, but there may be enormous savings that we have heretofore rejected simply because nobody's willing to think a different way about how to build some of the state buildings.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I do know, and maybe at some point it would be appropriate to have Portland State here, that the Vice President has been in discussions with some of the developers of the North McAdam area in Portland. This is not my area of expertise, but I think the way he was explaining it is that if Portland State got involved in some kind of arrangement with the developer, and I think he even mentioned Oregon Health Sciences University, then they would build it, and then we would somehow lease from them, and that may be a variation of the theme that you're talking about. But I have no idea whether or not going to be a realistic option.
Thanks. So it answers my questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your
question. But I do believe it is being done. I think that's what the ODFW building, mm-hmm. a developer is building that leases back. If you could see
him.
Pardon me?
It's taking shape, too.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, with that, I was going to leave the discussion of the laboratory rent increases and move to the final. Just quickly reiterate what I indicated already is that we have four policy packages, 101, 102, 103, and 104, that are ratifications of fees that were adopted last session. I believe you're going to have a hearing on this on Monday, which is Senate Bill 197 anyway, so I don't know if there's any point in my taking much time on that today. At this point, I would actually close my presentation of the agency overview and request your support for the budget to help us accomplish our strategic directions and support the legislative priorities and the changes in our customer service and process improvements that we're trying to make at DEQ. And I would refer everyone to Appendix A08, which is where we have responded to the co-chair's questions, and we can talk about the materials that are presented there.
Before you do that, Stephanie, let's ask if there's any comments or questions from the committee at this stage. Okay.
Okay. And I would ask Holly Schroeder to join me at the table, since she's actually the preparer of much of this information for you. Appendix AOA responds to questions about vacancies, FTE, staff to manager ratios. It includes our actual list of vacancies. It includes the priority list that we were requested to provide. It includes the 30% cut list. That's what's in here, and I'm just going to start walking through it unless you want to address it in any particular order.
Just walk through it. That's
okay. Is everybody with me in Appendix A08 before I get
page one.
Page one. The personnel issues with regard to vacancies, we started actually way back in February of 2002 with hiring freezes to manage the budget. Then there was a statewide hiring freeze in June, so that as of February 12th, we had 94 vacancies at DEQ. 32 of those are budgeted in full or in part on general fund, and 21 of those have been reduced through House Bill 5100. The remaining 62 vacancies are budgeted all or in part on other and or federal funds. 10 of those other fund federal fund positions are dependent on the approval of the 0305 budget for continued funding, and another 11 of these are not funded in the governor's balance budget. And as I said, we attached a detailed list of all the vacancies, and including explanations for each individual vacancy.
Question?
Okay. With regard to FTE and positions, we have 126.75 FTE and policy packages. Of these, 21.5 are restorations and 93 are continuations. These positions are currently in our 0103 budget. They're authorized as limited duration positions, and they need to be reauthorized, and that's what the budget request does. Some are for projects of a limited duration but longer than 2 years. An example of that is the Lapine on-site demonstration project. And for some, the long-term certainty of funding was unknown at the time of budget approval, such as for federal grants. Of the 12.25 new positions in DEQ's budget request, none are proposed on general funds or lottery funds. Federal funds support 7.25 FTE, air quality monitoring, data management, and the Umatilla project, and also the EMAP project, and an additional position for the Lapine on-site demonstration project. Other funds support the remaining positions. 2.5 FTE are funded by an expanded fee payer universe in the new Stormwater Phase 2 section that you've heard about. No fees are increased. It's just an increased number of applications for which a fee is associated. One is supported by fees in the State Revolving Loan Program, and that's to manage the State Revolving Loan Fund that we actually give out to small communities. One, as you heard from Helen Lottridge, is to support fees in the Pollution Control Tax Credit Program with, again, increased volume of applications. And then the infamous 0.5 is to oversee our facilities, which I suspect we might as well not talk about very long today, given our conversation yesterday. If you move to page 2, we get into the staff to manager ratio that was requested. Overall, agency-wide, the ratio is 1 to a little over 11, one manager for over a little over 11 staff. And you can see that that is true in air and quality and land quality. Excuse me, air and water quality. And in land quality, it's slightly under that. It's 1 to 10. And then the agency management, we have a caveat because, as you heard yesterday, agency management is actually combined with the director's office. And so you have people in manager classifications. For example, we gave the deputy director here has 10 reports, but only one of those is budgeted in agency management. So if you just look at purely at agency management, it's only 1 to 5. But if you count in the director's office and the example I just gave as 1, it goes up to 1 to 9. So we range from between 1 to 9 and 1 to 11 throughout the agency.
And Stephanie, does that change the ratio then if you computed on that basis with the other three categories?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Holly Schroeder, it would change the ratio for the agency as a whole. It would not change the ratios within the three programmatic
would
areas.
Would it make it go up or down?
It would make it go up, because you would not have that 1.548 average pulling it down there. just slightly.
Okay. We're really going to shift gears and go to the priority list, so let me pause if there are any questions here.
Any questions at this point?
Okay, the priority list is in this package right behind the vacancy report. It's a single 8.5 by 11 sheet. Says prioritize list of all services, Department of Environmental Quality. You asked also for guiding principles. The guiding principles that I've referenced in page 2 of this memo: maintain environmental accomplishments to protect public health and clean water, air, and land, enhance services that make it easier for businesses to locate and thrive in Oregon, keep delegation of federal regulations so the state, not the federal government, carries out federal environmental laws in Oregon. Those were the guiding principles in developing this list, but let me give you a little bit more specific detail in how the list was put together. Priorities 1, 2, and 3 on the list, which are Umatilla, spill response, and protecting drinking water. The logic of those being at the top of the list is to protect Oregonians from imminent harm, and that's why they're at the top.
Stephanie, let me, so I understand this better at least. Are these, have you broken out what is mandated by statute?
On the Mr. Chair, the column on the far right gives the citation, the statutory citation for these requirements, yes.
And is there any language in those statutes that says if funds available, or what I'm trying to get at is if we have a legal responsibility to fully fund some of those programs?
Most of, as I discussed in my overview, the delegation of federal programs is to a certain extent optional. I mean, we have, and one of our guiding principles was to keep delegation. We have accepted delegation over the years in Oregon. So if we have accepted delegation, then we've accepted the responsibility for implementing the requirements of those federal laws. That said, and I will get to when I talk about the priorities here that pertain to delegation, the state could make a decision that we don't want to do that anymore, and we could give those programs back to the feds, and then those statutes and laws would not apply. So it's kind of a different answer to your question.
No.
And then there are obviously some state-mandated programs as well. But we've tried to give you the statutory citation wherever possible, and if it isn't sufficient, let me know and we'll try and do better.
Okay.
So the first three have to do with imminent harm to Oregonians. The second priorities, number 4 and number 5, have to do with what my shorthand for it is setting goalposts and really checking on the state of the environment. Before we go off and do programs, we have to figure out what the problems are that we're trying to solve and the goals that we're trying to get to. And so that's the logic for priority 4 and priority 5. And then priority 6 through 9, those are all of the delegated, that pertains to all of the delegated programs. 6 is water, 7 is hazardous waste, 8 is air, and 9 is underground storage tanks. Those are all delegated programs. The logic in 10 and 11 is interesting because the delegated programs, as I've discussed with you earlier, really focus on the federally delegated programs on the regulation of point sources. And as I have commented, for both air and water, most of the pollution these days is not coming from point sources. So priorities 10 and 11 address in both air and water the work that the department does in air with area mobile small sources, cars, wood stoves, burning, whatever, and in water with so-called non-point sources. And that would include our 319 program. Then priorities 12, 13, 14, and 15 provide some kind of incentive or assistance to, in part, not entirely, but in part, some kind of assistance or incentive to economic growth. I think that's pretty obvious with the state revolving fund loan program, with pollution control tax credits on the vehicle inspection program. As you've heard us testify, if we don't keep the airshed clean, then businesses cannot expand in that airshed. And then finally, cleaning up contaminated sites from past practices. Hopefully some of that land can then be reused for industrial purposes. And then the final two on the list, 16 and 17, regulating solid waste disposal and recycling, and this and septic system installation. Those are programs that are already in part delivered at the local level, and they could in solid waste, there are some regulatory aspects that I think we might not be able to delegate, but the state, Oregon state statutes basically put solid waste authority, solid waste planning authority at the local level already. And so that's the rationale for those being placed at the bottom of the list. So that gives you sort of the framework in which we worked to develop this list the way we did. And believe me, it wasn't easy, because we think everything we do is important and hard.
Representative Morgan?
What the instructions were was come up with a 30% cut list that the governor directed the agencies to put together, what the previous governor actually. And my question is, are all of the things on this list still available to cut, or have part of these already been taken as budget balancing strategies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, some of them have already been taken. Is that Holly's going to keep me honest here? I was going to go over the 30% list next, but she's will help me crosswalk a little bit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the numbers that you see
prioritization of services.
Right.
That's my question.
Just to complete, this is based on the governor's, the numbers you see here are based on the governor's balanced budget. So anything that was included in the budget that was taken off that 30% list would not be reflected here, because it would have been already cut.
Then I still have a good question.
Okay. You got a contest going?
I want to solve it to this spreadsheet. The last one, two, three, four, five items have no general fund or lottery funds in them. So in terms of using them for prioritization, is it a true statement to say that those items, even if they were decided to be taken off the list of services that would be funded, it wouldn't have an impact on the general fund situation? Is that true or not true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I believe that is a true statement, yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Now, I think the next, let me just check to your list here. Before we go into the 30% list, you had requested some discussion of program comparisons. And if you go back to page 2 of my memo in this appendix, we did some research. We didn't do all 50 states, I have to confess, but we do know from being involved in national organizations that most states organize their environmental programs differently. Several have departments of natural resources, which includes functions in this state, the Department of Ag, the Department of Forestry or Water Resources, Fish and Wildlife. Some of those are all in one place. Others combine public health and environmental responsibilities. We do have a comparison for you here for the state of Washington, and also the state of Idaho and the state of Minnesota. And we picked the state of Minnesota because they're relatively similar in size and how they organize. And so we have a little table of how the state population of those states compare to Oregon, the total funds, and the general fund, if you will. They call it different things in different states, and the FTE. And I don't know if that was responsive to your request or not. There's also a reference to a website for the Environmental Council of the States where there's actually more information on state budgeting, and I think we have an attachment. We've pulled that article out, and we've put it in this appendix for you for your evening reading pleasure.
Stephanie, could you talk about these figures, Elvia? Initially, it appears there's a story here.
Well, I think to a certain extent they reflect the size. That's why I asked the staff to actually put the population of the states in there. I mean, we picked Minnesota, for example, because they're similar to Oregon in that they have one major metropolitan area and then the rest of the state is relatively rural. Washington is not exactly that way. I mean, it sort of is with Seattle, the Seattle area, but they also have some fairly significant urban areas throughout Washington. Idaho, of course, is much smaller, but they are our neighbor. Idaho has, EPA runs some of the programs in Idaho. I think that the others, the delegation scenario is pretty similar to Oregon in terms of running this federal programs as we do here in Oregon. I don't know what it tells you except that Washington Department of Ecology has a lot of money and a lot of people, quite frankly. And they have some challenges. They have Hanford that I think, to deal with Hanford. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there's any conclusion, although Holly's looking at me in that way that says she wants to say something, so I will see if she wants to add.
Mr. Chair, Emerson Finney, I just wanted to point out that we did attempt to do some normalization. So, for example, just because Director Halleck mentioned Hanford, Washington does have a nuclear waste program in there, and we actually backed those numbers out. So we tried to do some general normalization, you know, based on what we could tell, and this is all based on information that was available publicly on websites based on published budgets from those states. So we didn't go into excruciating detail in our research on that.
I guess what I'm intrigued by is comparing on Minnesota, which has a lot of water bodies, and I would think and more population, but less FTE, considerably less FTE. And I would imagine you need to go back and look into their figures more of what's going on there. But
Mr. Chair, I don't know many of the details of it, but I do know that one of the things that I noted here that's unique about Minnesota is that the agency in Minnesota is called the Pollution Control Agency, and it is a strictly regulatory agency. They have a separate agency that I can't remember what it's called, but it serves as sort of a pollution prevention and sustainability organization. So that is a separate agency from the Pollution Control Agency and is not accounted for in these figures. So I would have to go in and dig more to learn more about how those subtleties of how that's all organized.
Representative Morgan.
I just want to make sure I'm reading this right. The box that delineates the state non-dedicated fund, the general fund, that number in there is part of the total fund number above it?
This. Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that's correct. It's a subset.
Okay, so you have at Oregon DEQ putting about $20 million more into issues than the Washington Ecology Department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the total funding for the Department of Environmental Quality would be larger than Ecology's. The state support would be less. I suspect that what I would have to check there is the total number for us includes our non-limited budget, which includes the loan. And given the discrepancy in the FTE, I might suspect that that type of equivalent number is not included in Ecology's budget.
That was the question I had, because it seems like, however, they managed to hire 300 more people for $30 million more dollars is an interesting story in that there may be things missing or...
Representative Morgan, my suspicion is that that they have a different way of accounting for what we consider our non-limited, which is part of our budget, which is one of the reasons why during my presentation earlier I tried to distinguish between our operating budget and the total budget for the agency. And it would take additional research in order to and actually talking to some people at Ecology in order to figure out what do they consider their actual operating budget, and does this number reflect that? And how did their budget structure? Because as Director Halleck alluded to, not only are the organizational topics covered by a given agency different from state to state, but the budgeting mechanisms from state to state are very different, and so we would need to try to figure that out. It's and we've not done that level of research at this time.
Well, and I think you've hit right on the head the problem that we run into consistently in LFO with trying to compare functions across states. The amount of energy it takes so that you're looking at the same basis, it's virtually impossible to grapple with it.
It's very difficult, Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan. I mean, that's why we tried to include also the Environmental Council of the States article. But, for example, I know in ecology, my counterpart, Tom Fitzsimmons, he has all of the water resources functions in the Washington Department of Ecology, but he doesn't have the septic tank program at all. And there are other things, I mean, there are anomalies like that throughout. Okay. But we'd be happy, if you want us to dig a little bit more, we'd be happy to try and do that.
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, what it would get us for the amount of effort that it would require you to go to.
I'm sitting here thinking, oh, what might be more meaningful is if we knew what standards we on the West Coast are trying to meet as compared to standards on the East Coast. Because I've heard from legislators or congressmen that it is much different in different parts of the United States. But even then, that's not all dealt with, as you're saying, through the same kind of departments. And so it would be probably unfair. But it would be nice if we could find some source of information where we could
Mr. Chairman, it might be an excellent research project for graduate students sometime.
Yeah. Have anyone in mind?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I've always found these kind of comparisons interesting but not particularly helpful because we have the Oregon way of doing things. And they have their way of doing things. And we all regulate similar but different. And our laws are all similar but different. So unless you were to go into the policy side, we wanted to change policy to match the other states, it's really tough to compare us to anybody.
Okay,
the last thing I was going to go over then is, in fact, the 30% list, and that's in this tab as a fold-out on legal size. And if you'll indulge me in walking through it with you, I think that would be the most helpful. And here we go.
Chair, can I ask one question?
Sure.
I think it's maybe the same thing Stephanie just asked. Is one the most important thing for the agency to do, or the least important in the making?
One in this case, this is the reverse of the priority list.
Okay.
One is the first to go.
Okay.
And
okay.
Whatever at the bottom, in theory, would be the last. So,
Mr. Chair, could I also request, as Stephanie goes through this, if it's been taken or part of it's been taken, can
absolutely
you tell
that's
us
what
that
I'm
that?
Going to do? Yes, I will do that. Okay, so the way you read this thing, if you look under the left-hand side of the dark line, and you look under total funds for 0305, that tells you what was available to take in the GBB. And then you look to the immediate right of the dark line, and it gives you amount taken in the GBB. So as you go down the list, you'll see that the first item was all taken in the GBB. The second item was all taken in the GBB. The third item is a fund shift from, or a shift of activity from out of DEQ over to the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. And I don't know how to describe that.
Mr. Chair, item three, as we discussed, I believe yesterday, package 180 is a phase out of this money from our budget. It's a policy package that takes this money out of our budget, and there is a commensurate package in OWEB. So you can see in the comments that if this cut were taken, it would require an adjustment to the parallel package in OWEB's budget if you were to reduce it from ours and not add it there. So that's how that.
Number four, use attainability analysis has, to all intents and purposes, been taken. I don't totally understand the $32,000 that's left, but the function is gone, and Paul's smiling, so maybe he understands.
I have the same question.
Oh, all right. Sure. Holly will yet again tell us why there's still $32,000 there.
I think what, Mr. Chair, what's helpful to keep in mind as you look at this is recalling sort of the context in which this was put together, which was the 30% list was assembled and developed last summer. And in some cases, we used estimates because some of the information, you know, some of the information about what things were going to cost was not totally finalized. And then when we moved into the budget development process and the reductions from the special session 5, House Bill 5100, and then those rolling forward into the governor's balanced budget, when we actually had to go in and pick positions and say, you know, what it's going to be position number 1, 2, 3. The, you know, might have been at a different step or some other types of variations like that. But we'd estimated one position. We took one position. The cost was off a little bit. You'll see throughout that as you go down the list further, there are some where you actually end up with a negative left on the list, and that's because we had estimated perhaps one classification and we ended up taking a higher classification. So it all sort of balances out in the end, but it's sort of because there's this time lapse between when we first compiled the list and when we actually needed to select and finalize the implementation of the list.
So would it be beneficial for you to upgrade this list to present?
Mr. Chair, I guess if by your question you mean should we not have a remaining on list column and reflect that in our original proposal, we could certainly do that. We were trying to always keep track with where we started and how it's evolved, because otherwise we end up with people asking us questions about, well, I thought it was this other number before. So we could certainly, change what the original list was if that is clearer for the committee.
I think that was my question, that as I understood, you made this priority a year ago, roughly, and do you need to take another look at those priorities a year later?
Mr. Chair, that's actually, we'll give you even some more examples about which to raise that question, because I think we might want the opportunity to rethink some of these things, and as we walk through, we'll give you some more, even more examples.
Mr. Chair, if I might comment to that, I think it is instructive to walk through the original 30% cut list, because I think the members would benefit from knowing what choices have already been made in terms of what's left and why the choices weren't made on what's left in the first place.
Okay. If I may proceed. Then item number 5, the cross-program and green permits coordination, that has all been taken in the governor's balanced budget. Item number 6 was, even though we had it as a high-priority cut, there was a lot of consternation among the municipal stakeholders, and so that was not taken. But what we did do is go all the way to the very bottom of the list, which is reducing support for groundwater protection, and that cut was taken in lieu of all the stormwater cut that's in item number 6. So item number 6 is a cut that has not yet been taken, and in response to Senator Messerly's question, that might be one of the things that we would want to rethink as to where it is on the priority list, because our municipal stakeholders would not be happy to lose that. Item number 7, water quality monitoring position, that has all been taken in the governor's balanced budget. A position in our standards and assessment, where we set the water quality standards for whichever parameters in question, that has been taken. With regard to, I've made reference to our spill response and the relationship between spill response and cleanup. Our spill response program has historically been generally funded. We really have no choice about whether we do the work or not. So this, even though there is $408,463 that has not yet been taken in spill response, if it does get taken, we will move money out of the cleanup fund, hazardous substance remedial action fund that pays for other kinds of cleanups at DEQ to cover spill response, because we have no choice. We have to do this work. And that, again, might be one that we would want to discuss where it ought to be on the priority list. Item number 10 is in our air quality program, and all of that has been taken. $533,944 has been taken in the governor's balanced budget. The central government service charge is really not very much of an optional thing for us to discuss, so I don't know that we need to take any time on it. Item number 12, we have taken a fairly large amount. There's a $2.7 million in general funds servicing the debt for the state revolving fund. I think I had mentioned to you that there is an ability to use the interest that comes back into that fund to service the debt and have it become self-financing. So far, $870,000 has been taken for that purpose. There is still $1.9 million potentially available, although EPA has started to push back a little bit on whether or not it's appropriate to make that program entirely self-financing. So that would be something we would want to discuss with you further in terms of taking that cut if we're allowed by EPA as opposed to taking some of the other cuts. In the hazardous waste program, this $376,000 for hazardous waste technical assistance, this doesn't have EPOC in it, right? Okay. This is tied into the discussion of Senate Bill 196 that I don't know that it has been referred down to you yet. This is general fund that funds our business assistance program to hazardous waste generators. We have been working with the fee payers in this program on Senate Bill 196 that has a fee increase, has also an element that proposes to shift some of DEQ's penalty money that would normally go to the general fund to DEQ to pay for hazardous waste technical assistance. If this cut is taken, if this 376 is taken, and if there is not support for the hazardous waste program in Senate Bill 196, we cumulatively have a big problem in the hazardous waste program. So that's the significance of that cut right there. That's about, I think, two FTE in the hazardous waste program. Item 14, in this particular one, in our view, we have taken what we can. The initial availability was $523,786. $361,602 has been taken. The money that's left basically pays for our water quality land administrator, and those people are really essential to the operations of our business. Number 15 is a cut that we think we may still have to take. There were some special session pre-cuts that didn't make it into the governor's balanced budget, so we're anticipating that this is a cut that is still to happen. Number 16, water quality monitoring, TMDL program. That one is one of the ones where Holly indicated there might be a minus because there was actually more taken than what was originally available, and the same with the one below it for water quality biomonitoring. Those have both been taken in completion. The wastewater permitting program, we have taken some. You can see that it was 1.2 to start with. 471, 600 has been taken. There's still 761, and as I will remind you as we work down this list, these are obviously our more important things that we're trying to say, which is why they're at the bottom of the list. Water quality monitoring, again, started at 610. About half of that's been taken, or a little over half of that has been taken. TMDL development, again, a little over half has been taken on that one. And on the air quality permitting program, about a third of that was taken, and we're concerned about taking more of that, that it might affect delegation of the air quality program. So in the overall, and then the bottom line is of this list is about 16.31%. And as you can see, everything that's on this list has been touched in some way already. It's not a question that somebody drew a line somewhere and this took what was above it. It's all been touched in some way. The outstanding issues that could add to the amount of the cut are whether or not the Special Session 6 cuts roll forward. That would make this number go up. And then the issue about the Special Session 5 cuts that were not that were inadvertently omitted from the governor's balanced budget that we assume will get added back in would also make this number go up, and so we're anticipating that that 16.31% could go up to about 20%.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Do you have a bottom line number for the cuts that are remaining that have not yet been taken?
Probably, but I don't know if we have it here today. Just adding all those up, is that this number here? No, it's not.
6.6.
I don't think we do on this page, but we'll get it for you, Representative Morgan.
The interesting thing would be to see if your funds, you've got about $35 million between general fund and lottery fund in the governor's balanced budget. What percentage of that is left in your cuts list? I think the difference or the ratio between what's on your cut list that you haven't taken and the need to come to the diminished funding level that the co-chairs have directed us to.
I think I understand what you're saying, Representative Morgan.
And when can we have that? We need that.
Well, Mr. Chair, what I hear, if you'll indulge me here, kind of from a comment point of view, is trying to work with this list may not be the most productive thing to do, that considering how much of it's been done and the reasons that the things that were rejected for, that just simply going and taking what was rejected may not get us where we want to go. Would you comment?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, I think what you're asking, and correct me if I'm wrong, is really more, would it be more productive to look at what's left than what's been taken already and why?
I think what we're trying to grapple with here is that we know we have to come off, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10-11% from the governor's budget to the level that the co-chairs have instructed us to. I don't know that this list can get us there.
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan and Holly can and certainly opine on this, but it goes, I think, to the chair's question initially about would you want to take another look at it holistically. I mean, the factors that are out there are we have the governor's balanced budget, then we have whatever the target is that we need to shoot for, that you all give us or whoever does above and beyond that, if that's 10% or 15% or whatever. And then the challenge then is to in fact look at what's left, and also whether or not how the potential roll up of Special Session 6 might factor into that, and can that be relooked at again?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think we would be happy to sort of to come up with another list than this, if you will, of what it might look like factoring all of those things into it, if that would be more useful to you than working with the old 30% list. Holly wants to say something too. Maybe you can do
Mr.
better.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, all I was going to say is from a purely fiscal standpoint and perspective, if the additional reductions that we're directed to take as an additional, say, 10% off of the governor's balanced budget, there are enough fiscally left on this list to accomplish that. And then the question, I think, goes back to
would they
be the things you would choose from a policy perspective? And that's, I think, what you are alluding to.
Well, and then the point that the director raised about rolling the Special Session 6 cuts forward into 03-05 and what kind of impact would that have on the discussion?
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think the last pieces of that are discussions we're going to have with every agency, because their budgets were already submitted by the time we got to special session six. But I would like to see a new list, removing everything that's already been gone, sort of a cleaner list. And then you expressed some thoughts that you might rethink some of your priorities, and so I'd like to see where your priorities land now, understanding that any list is up to our pleasure as to where we go with it. And so our priorities may be different than yours, but I'd be happy with a cleaner list that just trying to go over to the right-hand column and figure out, you know, what's left and what isn't left and some of the difficulties.
Mr. Chair, if I may, if we could clarify before we march off to do that, what the target is, that would be helpful. Are we targeting 10% or 6% or 15% or do we know yet?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
I thought the purpose was you've already prioritized. I guess this is the 30% list, so this is the governor's. And I don't know when we're done with all of the budgets that it's going to land evenly across the landscape.
That's the problem.
Yeah, so I guess I'd like to see maybe a revised 30% list.
I understand.
And I think where we're going to end up with is that within the purview of the various subcommittees, there's going to need to be some kind of an effort to kind of dissolve the lines between the agencies that the subcommittees are hearing budgets for, and rank the priorities of missions more globally, and then rank the cuts and the add-backs more globally. And then I would assume there would also be a corresponding process across all of the budgets and all of the subcommittees to come up with some kind of a add-back list and a takeaway list that we'll take a look at towards the end of the first year of the funding cycle in relation to the revenue to decide which direction to move in.
So just one further point of clarification, if I may, Mr. Chair. For purposes of this exercise, then, we would take the cuts that have been taken in the GBB as given. We would not be revisiting any of that. It's just on this sheet I've gone over with you today, it's basically the what's left column on the 30% list, and redoing that, factoring in special session six and any other changes we might make to the order of this 30% list.
I'm a little confused here now, because realizing you work for the governor, and I guess I'm a little nervous about how much input you had as a department director into the governor's GBB list. My concern is that at some point you've got to run the department, and I would much prefer, if you have any concerns there, that we air that in our committee here. At least we're made aware of the information. But the bottom line is that when this is all done, when we analyze this, we want a priority list that we're going to review and make a decision on. But I definitely want a very strong input from all of the departments that we're dealing with. Having said that, even to add more difficulty to our job on the full ways and means, is that my guess the highest priorities are going to be public safety, public health, and education. So if there's additional saving, we're going to have to take some really, really hard looks at our natural resource budgets that are heavy users of general fund.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we should do two things. I think we should follow up with Paul to be sure we're all talking about producing the same thing, so we don't go off and give you something that's not useful to you. And I think we also need to talk with the governor's office on what they're pulling together with regard to sort of a unified picture of their natural resource agencies, because they've been meeting with all of us as well to go through a discussion just like this. And so we'll do that. Hopefully we can have some cohesion among these exercises.
Do you have any comments to make on these lines? Or I see your boss. No, I'm talking about Lisa in the back.
Oh.
Did you have any comments, Lisa?
She's come in to save you.
Here she comes.
Chair, before Lisa comes up, I might just mention that the co-chairs did make a conscious decision not to ask agencies to update their 30% lists to fill in cuts that were taken in 5100.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to clarify that for Paul and Stephanie, at least my interest is cleaning up this list.
Okay.
Not asking you to go any further because we can't keep starting the process over again or we'll never get it done. But just yank out what already has already been taken. And
thank you. That's very helpful, Senator Dukes. Appreciate it.
Are we getting close to... Well, go ahead.
We're done. We're very close.
Mr. Chair, we are in the process. Excuse me, Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services. We're in the process of meeting with agencies and talking to them about their budget. I'm not sure what the time frame is. If you're looking for some sort of advanced product, and it sounds like you would like this revised list at least early next week, so we may not be able to produce it by then, but we certainly intend to keep the legislative branch informed as we go along.
Well, my interest is just not get caught here a month from now and where's the information. That would not be good for anyone.
And Mr. Chair, I am on Monday, I am bringing back a number of items to you. We can bring back this. I think we can bring back this with Senator Duke's clarification easily.
And if you have any changes in prioritization, those can be reflected too. But Mr. Chair, it's something I would want to see with every agency. When we first started looking at 30% lists, seems like I have a lifetime ago, they made some sense. And now they're difficult to scroll through just because we've picked and over the bones so much. And so just something that is simply easier to use, not asking them to dig deeper, but just kind of clean up the current list so we don't continue going over things and thinking, oh, we can take this. Oops, we already took this one.
Okay. And your presentation is done?
That would be concluded, Mr. Chair.
I want to bring up one more subject, and I'm going back to the complaint and comments, public comments, or consumer the customer service comments.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get this information? Where does it? I'm trying to analyze what you've got here, and you've got that some of it comes from different, like, letters or whatever. Is there a, like, once a person is getting their permit, is there a form or something that they can offer an address even that they can respond to once they've completed the permit to?
Mr. Chairman, you are correct. There are three distinctive examples of how we get customer service comments on this sheet. The first, the table, just came out of the customer service survey that was done, where we actually had a telephone survey of 300 permittees and 200 septic permittees, 300 regular air and water permittees, and that's what that data shows. Then in the vehicle inspection program and in the leaking underground storage tank program, those are programs where actually people do get a comment card to fill out when they have a transaction with DEQ. And we have also, last year, we did that in the Roseburg office for our septic program. So the answer to your question is not every person who has a permit interaction with us fills out a comment card of some kind. We have tried to do it in our programs where we are having an interface with a small business or an individual Oregonian. Some of the people with whom we work on our air and water permitting programs are pretty sophisticated companies, large environmental staff. They're in sort of an ongoing dialogue with us about their permits anyway. Those were the folks we were trying to get to in this top level. I do think we could benefit from developing some more tools. I don't think we have, like in our cleanup program, there's probably more we could do in terms of getting feedback. So these are just examples of the things we're doing now, but it's not by any means, I don't want you to think it's
it's comprehensive within our department, because it's not, and we need to do more.
And I guess, and I don't mean this necessarily in a negative way, but I think there are a lot of people in the public who are very reluctant to make comments simply because they think it might impact a future permit or something like that. I'm not saying this in regards to DEQ, but in some of the other permitting areas, I hear that quite often. And so if we could, I think it's something that bears some thought. Is there a better way that we could get honest responses from the public? I don't have the answer, but it always bothers me when I see numbers like this. What exactly do they mean? Should we be drawing conclusions from it, or it's kind of like what we got into in comparing states? How you analyze those numbers, where they came from, can mean a lot. So.
I think that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of the committee?
Yes, just a comment. That works as long as we leave them enough staff to deal with the comments.
They were silent. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been very, very good information, good presentation.
Thank you.
We have one person who, Barry Chu from Farm Bureau, who will not be able to be here Monday. And Barry, you've signed up to let him forward. And by the way, we do have some extra time. If there's others in the audience who'd like to testify today, provided how long you take, Barry, we might have some more time yet today. So you might keep that in mind. Go ahead.
Chair Messerly, members of the committee, I am Barry Bashu. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I'm also a member of the local advisory committee that developed an agricultural water quality management plan for the Clackamas Basin. And my wife and I farm out of Gresham and raise berries, nursery stock, and flowers. I'm here today to express a concern about a specific proposal for expenditure by the Department of Environmental Quality. Farmers across Oregon have developed and implemented agricultural water quality management plans to protect and enhance Oregon's watersheds. This process, as a result of Senate Bill 1010, was supported by Farm Bureau and other agricultural organizations to help address the Federal Clean Water Act. It has been accomplished at considerable expense to farmers and Oregon Department of Agriculture. The TMDL process of the Clean Water Act was never intended to regulate non-point sources of pollution. This has been borne out by the Pronsolino case in California for the federal EPA, and more recently by the Haas case with regard to Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. It has been further augmented by a recent decision by U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to reject a 2000 administrative rule surrounding its own TMDL process and default to an earlier process. We are very concerned that DEQ has chosen to spend ever-decreasing state dollars to appeal the decision in the Haas case. Agriculture has made its commitment to Oregon's watersheds. We have established an excellent framework in which to accomplish this. The egregious use of TMDLs as part of this process is an impediment and a rejection of good faith efforts by farmers. We believe it should be and would be far more effective both economically and environmentally for the Department of Environmental Quality to work cooperatively within the framework that already exists, develop those programs to their potential instead of trying to replace them with other more costly alternatives. Agriculture has made its commitment, and we would like to hope and share that Department of Environmental Quality shares that commitment with us. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Barry.
We appreciate the opportunity for upsetting your schedule.
No, that's fine. We've got some time left here, so thanks. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify at this time? Go forward.
Chair Messerly, members of the committee, Catherine Venata, governmental affairs manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. While you have a few minutes, I'll go on the record today to save you the time on Monday. The Northwest Pulp and Paper Association is a regional trade association representing a majority of the pulp and paper mills in the Northwest on environmental and energy issues that affect mill operations. We were formed in the 40s to actually work with the mills to help clean up the Willamette River, something that we're still working on in our TMDL program at the present time. We spend a lot of time working with the department on air quality issues, water quality issues, and solid and hazardous waste issues that do affect us. As a general rule, the Pulp and Paper Association believes in state delegation of federal programs, especially in the water and air and hazardous waste areas. We believe that this is good for the state, and it is easier to work with the DEQ rather than working with the EPA, and that has been our position for a long time. We also realize that during this time of fiscal problems that the department is facing cutbacks. To this event, rather than whining, our association has stepped up actually to help the department fund things, to do the things that we believe are critical because they don't have the money to do things that are critical. For example, we have mills on the Willamette River. We're working on two TMDLs on the Willamette River, one for temperature, one for mercury. Our association, through a special assessment to our members, has provided money to do temperature monitoring, to work into the model for modeling the temperature on the Willamette River, which will be the basis for the waste load allocations that our mills receive. We've also participated with the department in the water quality standards area by providing receipts authority for work to develop a new turbidity standard, which impacts the issuance of our National Pollution Elimination Discharge Permits, or NPDES permits. We did this because 3 years ago when we started a triennial review process for water quality standards, that department of the DEQ, it's my understanding, has six FTEs. Currently, they're down to 1.7. Suffering quite a loss, not being able to do the work, we step forward. We did receive quite a hit from the environmental community for doing this, but we thought that it was the right thing to do because if we can't fund the work through general fund dollars, I ask you, how are we going to get the environmental work of the state done? We believe in doing these types of things. Specifically, one of our main priorities and a priority that the association has a task force aligned on is water quality and the challenges that we face for both the Willamette and the Columbia River, and we're quite active in working on those two TMDLs for the association. To that extent, we support the restoration packages for the work on the Willamette River. Specifically, that would be package 120 to do the Willamette Basin TMDL. We also support the fee ratification bill that would go back and ratify the fees that have been put forth in the last biennium, Senate Bill 197. Of those fees, we pay the ACDP fee for air issues, and we also pay the wastewater permitting fee increase. Those are two that we would pay, and we do approve of those, and we supported those last time. Personally, I have sat on the department's hazardous waste committee that's worked on trying to figure out how to fund the hole in the hazardous waste program brought on by the fact that our waste is decreasing at Arlington. There's a large fiscal hole in there. We all know that. I sat on that committee. We did support Senate Bill 196, which is still up in the Senate committee to deal with that issue, and we still support that bill to deal with that. We would ask that we believe that technical assistance, especially to small businesses, is a place where environmental improvement can be accomplished by working with the types of companies, unlike our large corporations that have large environmental staffs. I know the department has gone through that today. But we believe that you can have environmental benefit by informing the smaller companies about how they can do pollution prevention and reduce waste. Another issue that we support is the issue of dealing with their lab and trying to figure out how to deal with that in a cost-effective and way that provides service, especially with the importance of the work that that lab does with the health division. A little-known fact is that a lot of the work to accomplish the TMDLs in the state is done through the lab because they have a lot of monitoring and water quality testing to do. And a good lab staff with good facilities can accomplish that work. I don't have any easy answers about the rent and all that problem, but I believe that Representative Johnson started on a good path on a design build type theory to make sure that we create a good facility. And I'm all in for anything in Columbia County, hailing from that county. I know where Highway 30 runs, so does Senator Dukes.
I think we're outvoted, Wayne.
And I think that as we look forward on the different issues that face the department, and we look at the cut issues, that we try to prioritize together what we want this state to be known for as far as working with the environment and doing things. The permitting programs that we do here have been some of the basis for national programs in the past. Our air program was kind of like a foundation for the national Title V program, and now our Title V program here doesn't face funding problems, but the water program does because of the way that it's funded, and we have general fund in there. And we also believe that permitting programs probably should have some general fund in them because they are doing the work that benefits all Oregonians. Because if you have something that's 100% fee-funded, then it's just funded by the people who do it, and they have a large say over what's accomplished. This has been a large tension. I know you've heard it before, but it's something, a policy question that I ask you to weigh as we go forward. I believe, because I have been involved in the TMDL situation for a long time, that TMDLs are a very important part of the water quality work in the state, especially from the point source side. I realize that there is tension on the point source, non-point source side. I don't want to wade into that issue, but I do represent an industry that has point source and non-point source elements. Just so you know, the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association was a plaintiff intervener in the lawsuit that brought about the consent decree on the TMDL situation. OFIC, the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and Northwest Pulp and Paper Association were co-interveners in that lawsuit and did participate in the settlement of that, which led to the schedule for doing the total maximum daily loads, which led to the Haas suit. And so I've been intimately involved with that, whether I really wanted to or not, as the situation unfolded. And I don't have a lot of words for wisdom, except that this is policy in the making. And I wanted to point out to you how the working of TMDLs affects a point source on a river that has, that is, when the river is listed on the 303D list as being water quality limited for a certain parameter, whether it's a conventional pollutant or whether it's a toxic pollutant. The policy guidance from the feds and the state on this situation is in a state of evolution. And that means that if you are on a river that doesn't have a TMDL, and say it's listed for temperature, or say it's listed for dissolved oxygen or another conventional parameter, that you don't know what the situation is about getting your permit or perhaps having expanded waste load allocations there. And we saw this recently with the issuance of the Point Westward permit for the Point of St. Helens on the Columbia River. Situation with Representative Johnson and Senator Dukes are quite familiar with. That was a long involved process, took a lot of time, money and effort with everyone involved to work through that process, and a lot of uncertainty involved. When we have these situations where state and federal policy is evolving and we the businesses have to work through that, it's very difficult and time-consuming for us also, and I would ask you to think about that as you go forward and make your policy decisions, that water quality policy is evolving, whether maybe some other policies have leveled out and we kind of know what we're doing.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Both a comment and a question. I'm glad that you mentioned the Port Westward because I think it gives us a chance to acknowledge publicly how much help DEQ, and particularly Bob Baumgartner on their staff, was to the success of having that permit issued. And it was a complex situation, and I think I can say without fear of contradiction that DEQ played a pivotal role in having that permit issued. So this is a chance to put that on the record and acknowledge Mr. Baumgartner's assistance.
The question, Catherine, I don't mean this to sound negative, but it's one that comes up repeatedly, and I'd appreciate the benefit of your thinking. I'm very grateful that the industry is willing to step forward and by fee pay for services that are not otherwise available. But occasionally I have heard from colleagues criticism where industry is assessed fees with respect to a regulatory agency. Dogami, for example, where the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers members are paying for fees that then assist the work of a regulatory agency. And in the case where the pulp and paper industry is assisting DEQ. Give me your take on what would be an answer in response to industry participating with a regulatory industry in doing some of the environmental work that may be the subject of regulation later.
Senator Messerly, Representative Johnson, I'm having a little bit understanding what you're trying to get at here. Are you asking how we can work together to solve something later, or how we can financially participate in
a situation? How you would rebut the criticism that industry is involved in paying for certain environmental work on behalf of regulatory industries. Some people are critical of a partnership that I see as a partnership and one that's laudable, but more cynical folks might see an inherent conflict in that kind of a relationship. And based on your expertise and your industry's willingness to step up, I'm just asking for you to help me understand what a rebuttal position to that criticism might be.
Does it tip the scales?
Does it tip the scales? Senator,
thanks. I wandered all the way around it.
Senator Messerly, Representative Johnson, Senator Dukes. That is a very good issue, one that we have faced in our industry for a while, because we are set up to provide technical input to the departments, and we have funded work before the two projects that I've mentioned in my testimony, but also we helped fund work in the Willamette River studies, phase 1, 2, and 3, and we helped fund work in the Columbia River bi-state study work on the Columbia River for their long-term monitoring assessments and other projects. And we believe that industry has a role to play in being citizens that contribute to solving problems other than just being fee assessed. We do realize that some people view our participation as tainting the product. And we would and have gone to great extents that when we do provide funding to remove ourselves from the final decision-making process of what's done with the funding in order to present in order to allow the product to have the best chance of success, because we want to see it have success. As we're creating new policies and trying to fulfill the goals of the Clean Water Act, the agencies don't always have the answers. We don't always have the answers. And we believe that some of the things that we're doing here in Oregon with the narrative portions of, for example, our temperature standard, which allow for natural background and temperature management plans as ways of dealing with regulation is important. But sometimes you need data, and sometimes you can't get data any other way than to go pay for it. And when you're trying to meet the goals of everyday regulatory work, sometimes getting data is a problem. So we've mostly focused our money in helping assist on regulatory issues to data collection.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the best that I could provide for you at this moment.
That's great.
We do realize it's a problem, and we try to walk a fine balance of not participating to participating with a good record.
Thank you.
You know, I just can't help myself here to bring up another side of that issue. And I've seen this with ODOT. I've seen it with some contractors, construction people, in which, in ODOT's case, they literally have as part of their budget funding for Division of State Lands and funding for NOAA fisheries. so that they can afford to put on staff so that ODOT can get their projects going. And in my discussions with some contractors, they really feel like, hey, this isn't right. We shouldn't have to pay these kind of extra fees. But if we want our projects to go forward, we got to do it. Otherwise, it might take another 5 or 6 years to even get the projects going. So that's another side of this very delicate issue that thank you, Representative Johnson, for bringing up. It is a very fine wire, and I think it gets very close to holding people hostage. You either pay us some fees or you're not going to be able to operate. And it's always troubled me greatly. I don't know what the fair answer is, because some of these, as you mentioned, stakeholders come to us and say, hey, for us to operate, we need to step to the plate and get the staff there so that we can get through the process. In my opinion, we need to take hard looks at the process and what is the cost and is it fair? Is it overburden? And this doesn't relate. I'm getting way beyond DEQ's budget, but this state, I think, has put ourselves in a very, very difficult box. But any other questions of Catherine? I'm sorry, but I sure feel better now.
Maybe it's day.
That's the prerogative of the chair, so there's mm-hmm. payday. Yeah. Did you have any more to add, Catherine?
Yes. I remembered one thing that I had left out, another issue that's important to Representative Johnson and Senator Dukes and I, and that is the funding of the Lower Columbia River Estuary Partnership, a partnership that I actually serve on the board of. That's an outreach of the bi-state. And I have a strong belief in the work of this organization, and I do realize that the funding has been transferred from the DEQ budget to the OWEB budget, and we are in support of the continued work of that group. I wouldn't be sitting on it and going to their meetings if I didn't think they did important work. And I think that it's another tool in the toolbox for working on Columbia River water quality.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any more questions? Thank you, Catherine. And your timing is absolutely perfect. With that, we'll close the public hearing and adjourn the committee.